David, hello, how's it going?
Good so far. New year, new energy, and new challenges, I would say. How is it about you?
Everything's going well. It's January, so I'd like to ask our guests this question. How did Q4 go?
Very good at the end. I know that I was, the last week before Christmas, even 2 days before Christmas, or in between the years, I was like behind everything. And I said, let's sign order forms because every order form we can sign this year, even though the commitment and the AR comes next year, it accounts for this year's numbers. And we did some pretty amazing stuff, which we didn't expect, with bigger accounts, for instance, Google, that we got a big expansion. So it was really nice. And the team, I think, I was quite like, as I said, behind them, but they appreciated it and I appreciate it because otherwise we wouldn't have ended the year like this. And I think so from November to December, we got them 11%, 12% growth. So that was great. New Year started well. We had a big kickoff with the team, like 2.5 hours, maybe a bit too long. But it was good to see also the newcomers because we have now a few heads on different departments and they kind of presented their strategy and vision for the year. So 2024, here we are.
Yeah, okay. Glad to hear that. Today, we're going to talk about Surf. You founded Surf. Surf is a company that connects CRM with LinkedIn. But that's a software tool, but you were not a technical person. You actually have a different background. So before we start, can you tell us about your experience before starting your own company?
So I have a background in finance, actually. I did more than 5 years finance. I did mergers, acquisitions, M&A, and then leverage finance in Frankfurt. So I was very close always to kind of the corporate side, meaning I saw different companies who needed financing or financing for a takeover. So it was pretty interesting. And like my type, I would say is very creative. I did, before I kind of started my first job, 5 years of theater when I was in high school, which I really enjoyed. I think which helps me today a lot, speaking in front of people, for instance. And I still kind of, and I think the creative side was very much needed for the beginning of the company and the start because, next to finding your market, you need to also find your mark with your brand and how you can, between all these sales tech companies in the world, how you can be unique. And I think I could play my creative side. And now we are since 3.5 years, almost 4 years, with Surf around. And happy to be.
All right, that's quite interesting. From finance to software. So what actually made you start your own company?
So I always wanted to start something on my own. I didn't know what, but in my environment, my parents, for instance, it's a family company. I saw when I was small, every lunch we had, it was always a mix between private and company. So I was always, as a little kid, in the office of my dad. So somehow I thought, okay, I wanted to do something on my own. There was then a conflict also with my dad, actually, because he said, hey, why are you not going into the family business? And I said, no, I want to prove myself and I want to do something I want to do. And then I had a first venture, can call it a venture. It was in high school when we were 17. We were interested in stocks, so stock trading. But I mean, it was 12, 13 years ago. So in Germany, there was not a big crowd of stock investments. I think in US, 10% of the population invests in stocks or even more. In Germany, it was back then 3-4%. But we were interested into that topic, but at school, no one learns you or teaches you about. So we wanted to learn ourselves, had a little group, and we played some of these stock trading games, these virtual games. And then one day, the big stock trading came in Germany, ended their cooperation with the stock exchange in Germany. So we thought, okay, here's an opportunity. Let's do and create our own virtual stock market game, to teach you things about finance, what are stocks, how can you invest into stocks and all that. So we reached out to the stock exchange. We luckily had some coders at our school. So we set up a program. And I think this was very exciting. After a year, we got the Ministry of Education in. We got them 15,000 high school students, pupils in Germany playing that game. And it was a great adventure. And I remember that still 1 year after high school, I worked on that project before I went then into a professional job. And when I was in the professional job, after 5 years, I thought, hey, I really enjoyed the time back then, building time was 17, 18. So I would love to go back and then looked for different study programs because I said, hey, I want to take 1 year of free time building something, finding something, but with the benefit of having a degree at the end. So there was the entrepreneurship program I found in Paris, which was a bit more than a year. It was between an engineering school and a business school. So for me, it was a perfect fit because it's all about the people. And if you start a company with another business guy, sure, you can do e-commerce, you can do a platform business, but it's hard to do tech for you. It's hard to do a sales business or whatever. So that's why I chose this program. And I found my co-founder, Norma, or we found each other. And that's how LeadJet back then, that was our first name, and our surf started. Yeah.
All right, that's quite interesting. So you did have a little bit of experience with entrepreneurship before starting the company.
A bit, yeah. I mean, I said high school, but it was the first step, so it was pretty interesting, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Founding a company can be quite difficult, you know, just organizing everything and getting everything together. But how did you kickstart the whole project? How did you start?
So, yeah, you're right. We're a first-time founder, so it's not that obvious how you can start. I think it's important to start. And that's what I often say and when I talk with other people who want to start something. They first like think about all the different potential ways the company could go to. So they try to write down like a treaty structure of 10 different ways. And if this happens, then I go this route. And if this happens, then I go this route. It's too much planning at the beginning. And then you waste time to start. I think company building is building together with your first customers. You will always have a scrappy product, especially at the beginning. And your product may always change because it's based on customer discovery. And your customer will also always say at the beginning of your journey, your product is shit. So that's why it's hard to, when you want to start a company, to think about all the possible ways because technically you can't. And I think it's a bit of a waste of time. Of course, you need to have a plan, and but I think also you need to start quite quick. And when you start and getting into the process, you start getting into the building phase, and then you understand things better than you may just when you do it theoretically. For us, it was not planned actually. I mean, the Entrepreneurship Master, the plan is to start a company, but we have been on different projects. I was on a e-commerce project. Roma, my co-founder, was on a telecommunications project. And I remember it was the start of COVID, 15th March 2020. We were in the US for an exchange. So we get the last flight out of the US. The whole French group of students were like, okay, can we get out of the country? We need to get out of the country. How can we get out of the country? Is there still a plane going? So it was a bit like rough, I would say, at the time. But at that time, we started with the idea of Surf because we needed to do a big customer discovery for this e-commerce and telecommunications project, interviewing 100 people. We couldn't do it in person because it was the start of COVID. So we went on LinkedIn, searched for the people in the Bay Area on the West Coast, and then had a lot of interactions on LinkedIn. And we needed to save these interactions in our CRM, which was HubSpot back then. And there was no way. There was no efficient way to get these contacts, the contact data, the interactions we had into the CRM besides the manual way. And 100 contacts times 20 fields, you can imagine how much time it will cost you. So my co-founder, Omar, the engineering team, I was the business guy, I said, okay, I take 1 night, 2 nights, and I will do it, the admin work. And he said, no, for me, that's not a smart work. So I find a shortcut. You can do your way, and let's see which way at the end is faster or makes more sense. And he found a shortcut. And from there on, we thought, okay, maybe working with CRM, maybe that's something for sales. Let's flip and start customer discovery and salespeople. And slowly we got into it. And then we've built everything on the side. How do we start a company in France? What do we need to do? How much money do we need? Yeah. And it was all a bit scrappy and using Google to find answers. But it worked. And having then first advisors helped us, of course, to make less mistakes, I would say. And that was the start here.
Yeah, it's quite a story. One of the most difficult thing is securing funding. So how did you secure funding for your project?
Yeah, so for us it was important because back then in 2020, also bootstrap businesses were out and about. It was really trending. And I mean, trend is a weird word because a bootstrap business is a healthy business. So why should it be a trend? Every business should be bootstrap technically, right? So we thought about, okay, we can have a sales business. We can acquire first customers. Let's go the bootstrap route. We both put each around 10K at the beginning in the company. We also had a third co-founder, but he quit before we launched. So it was just then the two of us. And we said, okay, quick MVP building, 3 to 4 months, and then we build a customer straight away. So even though our product is not complete, even though it's not there where we want it to have it, it's a bit scrappy, but we build the customers. And the customers are then with us on this journey. And then I think it took, after the Product Hunt launch, 2 months, and we got 2 or 3 months, and we got the first 1,000 euro monthly recurring revenue. And we thought, okay, well, this is something. It's went quick. Let's jump fully on here, because still back then we had our main project. So we cut the main project and went on that journey once we had 1,000 MRR. And yeah, slowly from there on, we went, I think, then to 500K of annual recurring revenue, somehow after a year. And then we started to raise a seed round with 500K ARR. Because yeah, for us it was okay, here's something. I think we can reach or close to product market fit. We often say 1 million and you may have product market fit. So let's raise some money and invest into different hiring and have different positions, because we were still the two of us and 1-2 interns. So yeah. And then after 1.5 years, I would say more than after 2 years, till we got the money from the seed, we were financed. So things changed also fast, the perspective from being bootstrapped to being then VC backed. But yeah, that's how we did the first 2 years, was non-VC backed and bootstrapped. And I think it's good, and it learned us a lot of things, because we still have the same principles of being bootstrapped in mind, meaning we don't invest a bunch of money before we haven't understand the learning. Because what I saw, people now have money, so they skip the learning and they invest a lot of money, let's say, into advertisement. Problem is, then with ads, people come to your product, but then the product experience is shit because you didn't invest or didn't have much time to invest into product so that it's smooth and working good. So people then come and have this perception because they see you, let's say, at every bus station you do ads. They come and have that perception, I need to have this product, I see it everywhere. But then they come into product and they see, okay, shit, the experience is shit. And then getting this customer back is quite hard. So I would say here, you jumped over learning, investing in ads at the time when you think your product is scalable, makes sense. And for us, it was always then the case, do the learning. If we understood the learning, okay, we can skip the learning the next time. We can skip this next time and put in money to scale. And I think this is still our approach today.
Did you expect that it was going to be so successful so early? I mean, it's quite often what happens. A lot of businesses, 80, 90%, startups fail.
No, not at all. I mean, as I said, it was not planned. We thought it's just a side hustle. Maybe we can, after we launch a product, then can earn some money. But with the product and launch, the CRMs were approaching us, like HubSpot, and then we had a Salesforce integration. So we were thinking, okay, wow, they want to do an integration with us. They're way bigger. Do they know that we're just two students behind? We've built then an integration, official one, and partnerships, and then it went with them quite quick because they were basically bringing us customers. And sometimes it's that, because in business studies and entrepreneurship studies, everyone wants to go for the billion-dollar company and idea. So you limit yourself when you start building the company, of course, to and pressure yourself as well to go only for the big ideas, Industry 4.0, AI projects and all that stuff. So there's the big money and I should find something here. True. But for your first company and first venture, maybe you have more learnings when you start slower, maybe not with the big change in like, I don't know, mobility or whatever. Start slowly with your first venture, make all the different steps and learning of entrepreneurship, and then see where this takes you. And for us, this was great. We have a big addressable market, but we started very niche. We started very small with just this add to CRM button. So basically, we found product market fit just with one button. I think that's important. Start niche and then go out of the niche.
Yeah, okay. So as the company grew, how did you structure everything in terms, you're a person with a non-technical background, and obviously for developing the software, you need person or somebody with technical background. So how did you structure everything, just to organize everything that functions?
Yeah, so it was very important at the beginning for me and Omar. So the great thing was Omar is completely different. He studied engineering, so I come from business. So per nature, we kind of had automatically our domains. He takes care of the product, the tech, and I take care of marketing, sales, and all the rest, funding. So that was giving us, okay, easy decision making because if you have two business guys, I think it's a bit more difficult. Then, which is very not usual for a CTO. So for Omar, he took over the kind of legal stuff because it was in France and he's French. I have a French name, but I'm technically German, so I couldn't much help with the starting of the company and having all the different sheets filled out, all the legal stuff. So he took care then of legal. I think it was also better because he's a bit more nitty-gritty. As he's an engineer, he thinks about the details, I think, less than I do. I just go poof quick and then let's see what's kind of left behind. But it's also important because otherwise you don't move quick. So for us, this at the beginning, the different departments was quite clear. We also there's a test you can do online, or there's a bunch of questions. I think it was like 2 to 5 pages of questions finding your co-founder. So you align on different stuff. Hey, when would you leave the company, for instance, because of what events, what motivates you? When would you consider it a failure? When would you consider it a success? So many different questions, and we answered them to see how complement are we to each other. I think that was very important. And then it's about trust. Of course, we had some trust in each other because we were studying for 1 year, even though we were not doing every day something together before the company. I mean, we were in the same program, but we had this initial trust, which is important. As I also see other companies who start out who want to look after each other, so they want to double check, and sometimes then the trust is not there because, sure, at the company, you invest into each other, and then you say, I can take care about fundraising, but then if the fundraising takes a bit of a while, you're suspicious. Hey, is he really doing a great job there? Does he have experience in doing this? So I think that's then the start of a failure, because you don't put the trust in each other, but you need, because you don't have time to double check what the other is doing. Otherwise, it's too slow and you're not getting a head start. So we needed to trust at least for the first 8 months each other. We didn't really double check. Of course, we always aligned, but we didn't double check each other's work. Also, I couldn't double check his code, if we're honest. I think that's important, because that's what I see in failures of co-founders, that they don't have this initial trust because they didn't do the initial trust work. There will be phases where they kind of are suspicious, maybe suspicious of each other. That's where you need to trust. Then it can the little things can build up, and then it can lead to a failure relationship. Same like in a normal relationship, it's all about trust. So I think that's important, and was quite clear from our backgrounds who does what, so that we can complement each other. And the things where we don't have experience, we just took the different topics and said, okay, you do this, I do this, you do this, I do this. And then trust each other, go fast, start building. Yeah, that's how we started the first, I would say, 8 to 12 months.
Okay, so I mean, you and your partner, you probably had moments where you had different opinions about, let's say, a decision you had to make. So how did you sort that out?
Definitely. Luckily, we had almost from day one an advisor who was 60 plus years old. So he had several ventures started, also in our domain. So every time where we were like, we have no answer because we don't have the experience for it. We went to him and asked him. And sure, there was also one, two times where I was like, I think maybe Romar is not on his state where he should be. I think he I don't know, it's blurred at the moment for him. And he helped us to unblur it and clarify it. So I think it was just like one, two times. And I think it was on his side and also for me. And that's where really advisors are golden and help. So find an advisor for you at the beginning for the entrepreneurship side of things. Sure, also then advisors help you for product and different topics. But at the beginning, entrepreneurship side of things is very important, especially when you're first time founder. What is also very important, and you may forget about these things because you're in the building phase, you're in German, we say in the movie of things. Take the time for you as founders, meaning do founders offs, where you connect, always stay connected on a personal side as well. And I'm quite honest about it, because otherwise, if you lose yourself on the personal side and it's just business related, you may not see some things that may pile up in the relationship or whatever. So it's so important for us to do these founders offs, to reconnect. It's a few times over a year where we also say to each other, I would say, how much we love you and how much we appreciate each other, that he's doing that job, that I'm doing this job. Because often when you are working, you don't have time for it, and show appreciation for each other. And I think that's also important, because we founders also want to have appreciation. And of course, we also want to have someone saying, hey, I really liked how you did that. But it's not often the case, because your employees don't say that to you. You have each other to say that to each other and motivate and support each other. I think that's why it's important. So yeah, we have a drink. Sometimes we cry. We say each other honest words, and that's good. And we have the energy for the whole next year. And that's also important.
Okay, so you probably at some point realized that you needed more people. So how did you decide, you know, to hire in-house or to outsource somebody?
Yeah. So first of all, as we were bootstrapped for the first 2 years, hiring complete on your payroll was not super easy because the cash was not there. So how can we still move on with the limited cash we have? and not doing big hirings. There's a company in France, and there's several companies now, freelancer agencies, like for instance Comet, who helped us to find for that specific mission we had, a freelancer, to work on that mission. So we first hired freelancers. It was maybe, yes, a bit more expensive, but as we didn't need to have the commitment to hire, it was okay for that mission. And fun fact is, it turned out that we converted the freelancers who worked on our project to full-time employees to join our company, because that's how we always see things. Even though we work with freelancers, we want to include them in our culture, so make them, have them the feeling they are full-time employees. And since we did that, a lot of the people actually, so sorry for Comet, because we actually got the freelancers out of their model and hired them on our payroll. So yeah, this is how we started. First, freelancers, freelancer missions, and then if we had the money, we kind of hired them as a full-time employee. There are different ways of contract. Either you can work as a contractor, for instance, as a freelancer, or as an FTE, so then you have a different contract. We still have, for the remote workers who work from different countries, we work together with Deel, so they are kind of a contractor to us. But yeah, I think also for the website project, for instance, the big branding project we invested, we also hired kind of a team outside who developed the website, who developed the whole branding. So we went with a Focus Lab in the US, and then with Milsoi, or Mill 3 from Canada for the website. Here's where we hired or outsourced it. And then, yeah, small projects. I would say, especially at the beginning, and we, as I said, like, if we did the learning, we outsourced it. If we didn't do the learning or understood it, we first tried in-house. So I think that was our approach. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we can jump to some other things. So you deal with personal data. In that term, how did you tackle the problem with GDPR? You know, with just because you're connecting LinkedIn to CRM. So how did you manage that?
Yeah. So first of all, from day one, as we knew, okay, we will have dependencies. We will connect to the CRM on the one side. We will connect to LinkedIn. So we have two dependencies to these two companies. Meaning there's data which is on LinkedIn, and there's data which is in CRM. How can we create our product to be very light in terms of data, meaning there's either you're a kind of a data pipe, or you're a data owner, controller, meaning you host data. And we decided to go for the pipe. So to be very light, we don't save any customer related data on our servers. So the data from our customers, I mean, of course, we have data like usage of our product, etc. So basic data, which we analyze and save. But we are a pipe, meaning either the data is saved on LinkedIn side or on the CRM, and we just push it through that pipe. So this is for us very light in terms of GDPR, first of all, which helped making things easier, faster, also in sales with bigger clients, because we just have a lighter due diligence. And then it's about how GDPR, especially in countries like Germany, for instance, which have very strict GDPR rules, it's mostly about the outreach. So meaning when you, for instance, contact someone without getting their approval, so you send them a cold email, let's say. What we often say to our clients is, because technically this question is not for us, it's we get the data into your CRM, but it's then about you, what you do with the data. So you do the outreach and write them an email, etc. Then you come into GDPR. But what we say is, first, add them on LinkedIn. So that's also how our flow of product is structured. And because when you connect on LinkedIn, LinkedIn is a B2B professional network. So everyone is equally interested in doing business. So that's kind of a first buy-in, let's say. Then you connect to LinkedIn. Then we can enrich the email address and the telephone number. And then you can switch to email and send this person an email. Because the initial step of a LinkedIn connection has been made, you can suggest, you can say that there has been a legitimate business interest. And with this legitimate business interest, thanks to LinkedIn, you can send an email, which is then not that cold. This is actually in the gray area of GDPR compliant, also in strict countries like Germany, because you had this, I would say, light buy-in thanks to the LinkedIn connection.
Yeah, okay. So you offer different plans, depending on what somebody needs, and those plans offer different features. So how did you figure out, how to price those plans? Because you don't see many companies like yours, offering your software service. How did you figure that out?
Some may say we just did it like with the finger at the wind. Okay, where the wind blows, that's our pricing. But yeah, we put initially, I remember it was a session of 4 hours with one of our first hires, with Omar, the three of us, trying to crunch the pricing. And at the end, we started with a standard pricing in SaaS, which means you have three plans to have the popcorn effect, or the McDonald's effect when you go to McDonald's and you have a small cola size, then you have medium and the big one. The medium and the big one, the price is so little that you always go for the big one. So yeah, same methodology. You can also put the SaaS pricing. So yeah, we sell less the entry plan. We often sell then either the middle tier plan or the higher plan. When you give the discounts, we had a monthly to yearly discount, which is quite prominent, of 15 to 25%. At the beginning, we had the higher discount. Then with the years in the company, we have a lower discount from monthly to yearly. Because yeah, for us, cash flow is important, meaning if we can sell more yearly, it's better for the company, especially when you're bootstrapped. Hence why we had here a 20% discount. And then, yeah, making the limitations of the plans just like that it hurts, meaning like, now I have all these features. I would love to have this feature as well, but then you need to upgrade. So finding these little things, then you go also with psychological pricing numbers. In States and Europe, there is like the fives and the nines. And then you adjust also this pricing. That's what you all can read in. How do I find my SaaS pricing model? We then also chose a end user per license basis. That's still how it is today. It was also simpler for us in terms of billing, because think about this as well. If you have, for instance, a feature, let's say base pricing, I don't know, you have added 5,000 contacts, then it's the pricing of X, Y, Epsilon. If you have added 2,000, it's the price of X, Y, Epsilon. It's harder for your billing because you need to, but then if you go with Stripe or whatever billing system, it's a bit complex to set up. So keep it simple at the beginning. Just have two prices, pricing plans, I would say, and then maybe three, end user basis, then monthly to yearly. Don't give the possibility to mix. So we don't do that. You can have five middle tier pricings and then five higher tier pricings. We don't do that because it's very complex in billing. And that's how we found our prices.
Yeah, so basically test everything out. I mean, see how it goes first and then adjust according to the user needs. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. So in the beginning, you mentioned that Surf was called LeadJet in the beginning. So what happened? Why did you decide to change the name? Rebrand the whole company.
Yeah. So first name was actually Growster. But then I think after a week, there was a company in France called Grooster, which was very close. And he was like, I'm going to sue you. You're too close. We're in the same business almost. So change your name. Okay, now we needed to change. And it was an overnight change. So we thought about, okay, we are fast because we can add one-click a contact from LinkedIn to your CRM. So we need a fast component in the name. And we are working with prospects, leads. So that's why we decided there's always a decision making. Either you go for a name which is very close to your product, so the name itself or the product is in the naming, or you go for artificial name like Google to stand out then later on. So yeah, first we went for LeadJet, which was very helpful because people thought, okay, this has something to do with prospecting leads, and Jet gives the feeling of being fast and being like sharp. So that's why LeadJet, but then we couldn't brand market rights on it because there was a company in China, and we got a lot of support requests because the company is offering printers. So we got a lot of support, people asking, hey, I want to change my toner or whatever. Can you help me? My printer is not working. And we were, what the fuck? So we changed the name. And then it was name finding. We had 400 names, I think, on the list. So we included also everyone in the company. What reflects our culture in the best way. We are kind of bold, but also playful and fun. So what name does reflect that? And also we thought about the product, you know, we are surfing on top of your tools. We surf on top of LinkedIn. How can we put that also in terms of the product? And then we came up with Surf. So S-U-R-F-E at the end, because it's a name creation between surfing and serving clients. And also the domain for Surf, the normal domain was also for sale, but 4 million. So we couldn't afford that clearly. So that's why we added an E. And it fits pretty well because if you think about it, the sales words, I think because maybe software sales is coming from the US and from California initially, from the Silicon Valley, you have a lot of analogies to surfing. For instance, pipeline, it's a wave, right? So then we have, when we onboard new clients, you have the surf lingo, clients come in waves, navigating throughout, having times, waves, whatever. There's so much to do. And the sales symbol, I mean, when you want to call someone, if you flip it, with your hand, then it's actually a shaka symbol. So it's the surfer symbol. So that's why we often added this in at the end of the call. So all good. We are selling good vibes. That's our mantra. And yeah, as I said, we surf on top of your tools, serve the clients better. There's a lot of things that fits. Also little details like emojis, you know, people like that. If you can send the little surf emojis or the shaka symbol, people like that. It's the little things about your brand that makes a difference, I would say. So yeah, we went in with a branding agency in the US. It was a heavy investment, actually. But we decided, hey, we are here for long. So we invest the money. And as we are bootstrap business, we didn't invest that much in the history. So we said product can always be copied. But branding and relationships is harder to do and copy. So let's invest into it. And we saw after the investment and after we rebranded, we get a lot of big clients like Google, AWS, after the rebranding. So it's hard to always put a number behind rebranding in terms of what ROI does it bring. But what we saw clearly is bigger customers. We made partnerships and integrations with bigger companies who came also to us saying, hey, we heard about you. Hey, your product looks legit. Nice brand. So try to be that little, I compare it to a sneaker brand, which is fresh and which is new in the market and where big brands want to collaborate with. You know, in fashion, you see a lot of collaborations between big brands and new brands. So try to be that little new brand, which is fresh and which is exciting, where people want to hang out with, at least the bigger brands. I think that makes a lot of things easier than for you for partnerships. And we are partnership-led and product-led. Well, let's say we have a big self-service function, meaning brand for us is important. And that's why we did the investment. Yeah.
Okay, David. So we went through a lot today. What would be your, let's say, closing thoughts regarding your whole journey? So, how do you? You mentioned that you landed some big clients. So how do you do that? And also, you probably had some made some mistakes that were costly, both in terms of finance and time. So what would be your closing thoughts, maybe to somebody who's just starting their company and is looking for some
Yeah.
guidance?
So the big clients, we landed thanks to warm intros, almost all the big clients. Meaning, I knew someone, for instance, with Google. My friend was an SDR, BDR at Google, and he was coming to Berlin. I was working from Berlin the first 8 months, and he was working next to me. He had this big screen in his luggage when he came to the flat. And build up his little office desk, and then I saw that he was doing manual admin and data entry in Salesforce, and I said, "Why are you doing this? You know that we can help you here, and we automate that stuff, right?" And from there on, he did the introductions here and there, and it took obviously 1 year, more than 1 year, to land Google as a client. But when I think back, all the big clients was coming thanks to a warm intro. And now in our product division and development, we actually want to productize this approach, how we landed the big clients in a product. So how you can leverage warm intros and how you can also detect these connections easily. I think that's the best story you can tell when you look at companies like, I don't know, Lamblist. This guy was great at writing emails, and he's productizing his approach. Same for the guys from Lavender, for instance. And it's way better for storytelling. At the end, it's also story selling, right? So if you can tell your own authentic story, people will follow you. It's the same when you watch movies, right? We like to watch a motion picture, and it's based on a true story. So I think this is very important, and this is one of the things I can give to founders is see where you're good at, what's your genius zone, how you do your where you're great at, and then work into this, and then ideally productize it and tell that story because it's your own story, and then people will follow and buy it. So that's one of the advice I would say. And then it's injecting humor. Humor is very important. Yes, we are in a corporate world, and yes, we are in a B2B business, but yes, we are also humans. So if you can inject humor in your approach, do it. It's also, again, when you watch stand-up comedy, they have always a storyline, a start, a middle, and the end. And they don't tell one joke, they tell several jokes, but all these jokes feed into one big storyline. So try to find that as well in sales, and inject that humor, because you build up relationships. Don't look at it as a number, because these relationships will stay. As I said, with the big clients, we just had a small ARR, and then we expanded it over the time because of relationship at the end. So yeah, these two things: what's your genius zone? Can you productize it? Then tell the story about it. Ask yourself every end of the day, did I perform today the work where I'm best at? So if you realize you didn't, try to find ways to ditch that work, or get it to someone else who's better at it. Focus on what you are great, especially at the beginning, because this will give you a head start. And then have fun, inject that humor, because otherwise you don't have the motivation. And especially with big clients, I remember one of our first interns, who is still with the company, by the way, now. He said, "How can you chat with all these people? I mean, he's the CFO of a big listed company." And I said, "Yeah, it's human. And if you start with humor, you take a lot of pressure out of the room. And I think that's important. Then you can let your shoulders down, and the other person on the other side feels that as well. So you have a better connection, and this person can also let the shoulders down." I think that's some things I learned maybe in acting, or 5 years of theater, to have that atmosphere, create that atmosphere in the room. and that helps you a lot then later on for selling. I would say, coming to your second question, costly mistakes. One costly mistake is, of course, not hiring early enough head of departments. Because as a founder, especially when you have a great growth the first 2 years of the company, you think and you also want to do it for your journey. Hey, I will be the head of marketing for a while. I will be the head of product for a while. Or the head of sales, whatever. I can do it because I will maneuver the things before I. But when you're then a big organization and you go to a scaling phase, you don't have the knowledge that is required for that job because you didn't study marketing, you didn't work in sales for 5 years. So there's some things missing. Sure, you're fast in catching up as a founder because you learned how to do it, but it won't be sustainable. So I would rather say when you go into a scaling phase and hit 30 people plus, hire that heads also for your own sanity, because you can't jump between marketing, sales, and then being the driver of the company on a lot of different topics of organization and funding and whatever. So I think that costed us a bit of time. Last year was a lot of organizational things which we could have done better by just hiring earlier. So I would say this was a good learning. Next time if we ever start a company, I would do it quicker. But it was also a good learning for us and journey for us as founders. So yeah, that was a costly mistake, I would say. And we did a lot of smaller things every day, sure. But I would say it's the biggest one because it's where you also see a lot of companies going from an initial state to a scaling state. You need to be ready, have the mindset and the experience how you can take this and scale it. And if the organization is not ready to scale, but the product, everything needs to be in line. Product needs to scale, organization needs to scale. So it needs to happen at the same time. So think about it twice before you want to do it your own. Why do you want to do it your own? Are you really the right one to do it your own? Or should you better hire? So I don't know if it would have been different. If we would have hired the right person, maybe it would not lead to the results we wanted to have. We will see now. We hired department heads. And for us as founders, it gives also more clarity. And we can be more on the business strategy side of things, management side of things, have the bigger picture in mind. And now fundraising will be also next topic. To have our minds clear and free. And you will also then see and accept after a while that before it was individual contributor, you were as a founder, right? You were starting as a developer, starting as the sales, and then developed to now more, management role. And you need to accept and learn then quickly this role as well, and need to accept that you can't be an individual contributor anymore. And that's also good because otherwise the company can't scale. And then the company can also live without you. We can do for the first time maybe a holiday. And I remember when we did the first time holiday, fuck, will they manage it? I don't know. And because we were at the same time and not there. And they did great. So give the initial trust you had each other as a co-founder at the beginning also to your team, and you will see it beautiful things happen.
Yeah, and you probably had ups and downs. You weren't always going up, up, up. You know, you probably had a lot of problems. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what we love as well. It's a roller coaster. So it goes up and down. And most important is what I said also in another podcast is same like life, you know, you have ups and downs, but you need to feel right. So you need to feel always kind of in the middle of the things, even when there's down phases or high phases, because that belongs to life. It belongs to company. That's totally normal. So feel comfortable in the down and in the high phases, because also celebrate, for instance. That's sometimes what we forget, because we always have the next goal in mind. Celebrate also the highs, be there in the moment, and enjoy the ride like a roller coaster.
Yeah. Okay, David, we discussed a lot of things today. And it's really, you need to really be careful about every decision, every step you take, because you know, in order to have a successful company, you need to work things out, you know, because if you don't, you're going to make mistakes, as you mentioned, and just, you're not going to have a successful product. So thank you for being a guest on our podcast, The Roadmap, and I hope I'm going to see you again soon.
Yes, likewise. It was really a pleasure to be here. So thanks for the invite. And yes, anytime soon, I have my number or email. So happy to be invited again. I also start personally on podcasting, so let's see where this goes this year. It's one of the goals to do that more. And yeah, thanks for having me.